Hello again, friends, and welcome to Access City Hall for May 2018. I'm your host, Stu Levitan. The first function of government is the protection of its people and their property. In Madison, that awesome task is the responsibility of the Madison Police Department, which this year will spend more than $73 million in its pursuit. Our guest this hour is the man responsible for making sure that money is spent wisely and well, and the man held responsible when it isn't, Police Chief Mike Koval. Chief Koval joined the department in 1983, spending most of his career in recruitment and training. The Police and Fire Commission picked Mike Koval to succeed former Chief Noble Ray in April 2014. So, happy anniversary.
Or condolences, exactly, whatever the case.
Two or three words to describe these past 4 years.
I think volatile and exciting and ever-challenging.
And how have these 4 years changed you?
It's given me a perspective that I would have obviously never have seen solely and exclusively as a practitioner, hiring, recruiting, training people in best practices. I've come to walk more in the footsteps of our constituents like I've never done before. The community opportunities, the overtures, and the engagement opportunities, I think, have advanced me as an adult, as a leader, and hopefully has shown me insights that heretofore I would not have cultivated but for this opportunity.
How do you think you've grown?
I think I've grown in the sense that some would have said that, Chief Koval, you're very defensive of your officers. And I think my only sort of iteration on that sentence would be that I've always been in defense of the police officers who at times I think have been prematurely judged or stereotyped as sort of a one-size-fits-all response. And I think that obviously denigrates the incredibly well-balanced, well-educated, well-trained, and compassionate guardians that we're fortunate to have in Madison serving in the front lines.
And where do you think you're still falling short?
I think that in that sense, it would be that I still sort of look at some of the elected officials or the political posturing or rhetoric as sort of window dressing and pandering, and it still drives me nuts.
What do you know now that you wish you had known when you started as chief?
Well, I guess I wish I would have known to what extent you never become unplugged. I live in this. Polyester is very forgiving. It's a pajama. It's a night lounge wear. It's everything. You never really have a day off. You never really don't do work. You're always engaged. There's really no off button. So it consumes you. And at times I think that has been partly my work ethic, but partly the culture, the demands of being accessible to your constituents, of course, but also to your employees who are on the front lines.
Was this a surprise that it would be 24/7?
No, I don't think it was a surprise. I always sort of, from afar, from a lofty perch in training, presumed that we have, and we do, a very fine contingent of command-level supervisors who can manage the city quite nicely in my absence. But be that as it may, there is both a public demand as well as an employee demand that you are there in those moments when news is being made or when the community or its department is most vulnerable, to serve as, I hope, an inspirational benchmark as well as a platform for which people can robustly provide what those concerns are about how MPD does its work.
I want to go back to one of the answers you gave about your need to deal with people who you find posing for holy pictures and unfairly denigrating the department. What are you doing internally to deal with your frustrations and not be mm-hmm. so caustic and critical?
Well, and again, I think I would ultimately say that I've gone more and more to the platform of St. Francis of Assisi. And in that, it's I think it was attributed to him that is always necessary to speak honestly, semicolon, it's just not always necessary to speak. Better left unsaid.
And how well do you find yourself meeting that goal or that challenge?
I think sometimes I have better days than others, for sure. I have certainly some vulnerabilities in that domain, in that I'm not good at, I would never be a good poker player, in the sense that when I'm happy, you see it. When I'm angry, you'll see it. When I'm disgusted, you'll see it. When I feel like the comment is unwarranted, acrimonious, or pandering for showtime purposes, you'll probably see it.
So you're quoting Saint, you're going for this, the Franciscan model of outward action. This is to match David Cooper putting Gandhi and King on his office wall. You're going with Saint Francis.
I would say my mentor and certainly the face of what brought us into the forefront of community policing, David Cooper. I am unworthy to untie his sandal straps. I think he was much more self-disciplined and much more stoic in terms of his public persona. I tend to be more animated, and that's who I am. I try not to be specifically intentionally rude or off-putting, but I'm also not one to be cryptic when I'm at odds with something that is being said or something is being ballyhooed as gospel when I just don't believe it.
I'm going to get back to your relationship with David Cooper in a little bit, because there have been some, you just spoke incredibly highly of him, but there have been some moments over the past couple of years where there has been some degree of tension and disagreement, which we'll get to in a bit. Let's talk about the OIR group report. Mm-hmm. We're going to start with race. We're going to start with race. Any conversation about the relationship between police and communities they serve has to start with race. Madison Police Department made about 8,200 arrests last year, about 4,200 of Caucasians, over 3,600 of African Americans. And given that African Americans comprise about 8% of the city, that means that whites were arrested at a rate of 2.6 per 100, blacks were arrested at 27.6 arrests per 100. What accounts for that terrible disproportionality?
Well, there's an awful lot of things that are at play here. I think that when the police ultimately get called to a scene, and we average between 15,000 to 18,000 calls a month, depending on seasonal variations of sorts, but over 98% of those calls are coming through a third-party conduit, through the 911 center. You're a victim, you're a witness, you're a complainant. You're contacting us in some shape, form, or matter. So we are sort of inheriting the work that is before us. And so in that sense, you can't select out your demographics. You're dealing with the behavior, and is it at an articulable level that it reaches a legal quantum? Is there sufficient evidence to write a ticket? Is there probable cause to make an arrest? And even if you are making an arrest, do you feel that there is enough indicators within those set of facts that ultimately this could be a prosecutable case that would need proof beyond a reasonable doubt? So there's a number of constructs in place that govern what our response will be. And let's not forget, we can also counsel, release, mediate, or do nothing, disengage altogether. But the problem is that what we're seeing are the manifestations, I think, of desperate acts of people or folks who are inclined owing to desperate situations. We have obviously a paucity of what would be considered consistent mentoring to our youth. We have issues of school disparities where not everybody is enjoying or reaching high school equivalency diplomas or whatever. We have attrition there. We have dysfunction there. We have among the highest rents in the state of Wisconsin and the least amount of affordable units. So we have people who are, by economic throes, compelled to look at finite housing in congested areas that are already taking subsidies or allowing for those folks that have special needs. While we are, for all intent and purposes, at a phenomenal level of joblessness rate here in Madison, sub 4%, that is 4 to 6 times for African Americans. So not everybody is realizing the economic and the academic windfalls that so many of white people get. So when you look at the sort of the social, economic, and housing, and all these other things, not to mention AODA issues or mental illness issues, what we see then is that oftentimes the manifestations of behavior are results of failed institutions working in collaboration with one another. We're complicit in it. We have to own it as police, and we have to continue to look at what are those things that officers do or don't do, what are the unintended consequences of some of our protocols or SOPs or policies that have to be continually reviewed. But to suggest that we are the driving force for those disparities, I think is a little bit of a misnomer because it is so complex. The other thing that I always find sort of odd is that, and I can't disagree, the statistics are what they are and they're grim, and I'm certainly just as anxious as anybody else is to have a paradigm shift in that. But what I also see gets missed a lot is that when we talk about that 8% of our population African-American and how much more likely they are to be contacted, ticketed, or arrested, or prosecuted, or incarcerated, because there's other elements of the criminal justice program whose hands are stained and defiled as well. I think what we're not recognizing is, why is nobody asking about the level of victimology? Why is it that African-Americans are four times that ratio likely to show up in my blog as victims as well? So there are disparities on the consequential side of contacts, arrests, and tickets, but we also see an overwhelming disparity with those people of color who are ultimately landing up in the victim column as well.
So part of it is you agree with Bob Dylan that when there's plenty of nothing, it makes a fella mean.
Whoa. That is a little bit before my time, but that's actually very philosophically accurate.
Oh, it's Bob.
It is.
But the way you began that answer, you talked about there's always a third party that starts, which gets us right to the situation at the Starbucks in Philadelphia.
Yeah,
this is a perfect segue
very
to
topical.
It. Two men arrested for waiting while black.
Mm-hmm.
What would your officers have done? What would your dispatcher have done with the call? Hi, I've got two males here who aren't leaving, mm-hmm. and then what would your officers have done if they arrive?
Well, one of the things I want to point out, and often a lot, our constituent base don't realize it, when the dispatcher gets the call, they're setting the table, if you will, of expectations. Those are county employees. They are not Madison police officers or part of the MPD family. They have developed rubrics and protocols for how they prioritize their calls, and then the call is disseminated. I have a three-prong approach to every call we go on, and I've been teaching in the academy for the better part of my adult life. Number one, whether it's the most complex of investigations or the most benign parking complaint, three considerations come into every algorithm. Number one, community and officer safety is paramount. Number two, take and maintain control of that scene and the subject in it so that we have some stabilization from otherwise chaotic, frenetic, or out of control conditions. When you've done scrupulous adherence to those first two tenets, the third tenet is find the BPR. That's my shorthand for best possible resolution. And for my officers, I say, don't default when you're talking about BPR that the first option is always going to be a ticket or an arrest. Unless, of course, it's a mandatory area where it's domestic violence. If there's probable cause, there are no discretionary means. You shall make an arrest. But putting that anomaly outside of the window. So if that was us responding, if they're looking at BPR, I would think that we could have found a BPR short of handcuffing and taking people out and formally citing them. Now, I don't know if there was part of the preamble conversation, and on principle, the men decided not to move, thereby forcing the cops having to up the ante. I don't know enough about that part, but Clearly, that is not going to be the sort of crime I want us wasting resources on. Clearly, it's not the kind of incident that I want to create a record of an arrest or prosecution that's going to haunt someone for the rest of their natural lives. I would have liked to have seen some other method, some other disposition that wouldn't have resulted in that terrible optics.
I mentioned that before we started, that I posted the invitation on a Facebook page mm-hmm. to invite people to suggest questions. And someone had a question related to this. You have previously acknowledged that the department, well, I don't know if you did acknowledge that, but if you know that a call is race-based, and it's essentially a fraudulent, there's no business for the police being involved.
Right.
Is there anything that you can do to either, on the front end, screen the call at the dispatch level, and if it's a county employee, maybe that mm-hmm. it's out, but to ticket somebody who makes such a bogus call, how would your officers have dealt with somebody who made a call on two men who were waiting while black, and then mm-hmm. all they were doing was waiting while black? Should they have done something to deal with the person who made that call?
That's interesting, because a lot of these calls are obviously accorded confidentiality. If the phone rings in the 911 center, someone at some point has to take it, has to chronicle it, has to substantiate it to some extent. They have a protocol. But at the end of the day, the complainant, the person contacting the dispatch center, need not leave their name, a number, or a point of contact or reference. If someone were, in fact, to do such a thing, then I think obviously if it was someone who was literally trying to set up people for this sort of terrible outcome, then I think that we could look at it as a mechanism for creating sort of a false report of sort, because that's not the kind of thing that we would countenance. However, our criminal justice system is such as that we don't want to chill or otherwise delay, deny, or hamper people's ability to call us in real time about suspicious activities or things. So I would sense that from a prosecuting standpoint, there'd be a dim view of trying to go back to the source, unless it could be demonstrated that it was, as you sort of set it up, with the expressed intention of being intentionally malicious and looking to sort of be a race baiter.
Well, what if it's short of that, but if it's approaches a teaching moment that they get there in the office and the store manager says, they were just sitting there, and they said they were waiting for somebody, and they're making me suspicious.
Officers would be definitely doing an affirmative intervention, say, hey, listen, are you telling me that anybody and everybody that walks through this door and has ever exhibited the same behavior you're describing now, are they all being treated uniformly that way? And to what extent have you asked or mediated or explained what the options are? Because I'd like to at least, if nothing else, pursue that before we get to the point where we're literally ratcheting up this thing to that level. There's just no reason it had to go to that level.
Yeah. And apparently there will be a day when you won't be able to buy any Starbucks coffee in the afternoon because they're going to try and deal with it.
Yeah, 8,000 stores, right?
Sort of an inspirational thing for other institutions that are dealing with internal racism. We're talking with Madison Police Chief Mike Koval. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. It is the May episode of the Access City Hall on the Madison City Channel. Please stay with us.
They'll test you. Try to break your will. But however loud the loudness gets, however many cheese puffs may fly, you're the driver, the one in control. Stand firm. Just wait. And move only when you hear the click that says they're buckled in for the drive. Never give up till they buckle up.
Drownings are a leading cause of death for young children. Make sure kids learn how to swim. Always watch them in and around water and properly fence all pools. Simple steps save lives. To learn some new ones, visit poolsafely.gov.
Welcome back to the May 2018 episode of Access City Hall on the Madison City Channel. I'm still Stu, you're still you. We're still talking with Madison Police Chief Mike Koval. We're going to talk about the OIR group report. 2 years ago, you made some pretty caustic comments about the concept of the city spending $400,000 to study the department. The OIR group issued its 243-page report in December, 146 separate recommendations, many, perhaps most of which you endorsed. Mm-hmm. Was the study worth the $372,000 the city paid for it?
Well, that's a sort of pointed question. If I would say that if our constituents believe that they needed that independent examination from an arm's length, and it wouldn't be a self-serving, self-generated city sort of report, then yes, it was worth it.
It seems that, substance aside, you did have some concerns and criticisms about their research methodology. There were some things that they said they would come back and talk to you about that they didn't. There were some facts about department and union operations that they
were beyond the pale of my control, because obviously some of the union projections, wanting to put sergeants in a different labor classification and wanting to have not looking at seniority for closed positions, doing shift picks on 2 and 3 year cycles versus annual cycles. A lot of that is still subject to a collective bargaining agreement, and it can be a matter for discussion when the time is ripe, when we're not in a contractual cycle, but a lot of that stuff, my hands are tied.
But were there things that, the way I read your mm-hmm. response, and you put out like a 76-page response, so I guess if you combine your response and the report, it turns out to about $1,000 a page, which is a good rate for writers. That there were things that the OIR group said they would, that you were surprised that you weren't consulted, that they didn't ask you about basic facts about department operations, that if they had asked you, you could have explained and cleared up some uncertainties.
Yeah, I think there were some of those areas in terms of the supposition that all discipline results as a product of a negotiated settlement with the union. That's just not the case. There are instances like that. But again, I'm looking at, in its totality, I thought they were given a very ambitious RFP. I mean, normally, when a consultant group like that is called in, it's with a very narrow, more surgical focus. And I think they would even acknowledge that they had never seen anything as robust and profound and asked for metrics on so many different topical areas that, to some extent, I can acknowledge that they had a Herculean task and a limited window in which to do it.
The report found that the department was unusually progressive, effective, and ahead of the curve. But that the past couple of years had been particularly difficult for the department mm-hmm. and its community relations. And, quote, the impacted members of Masson's community and its police leadership could use a reset so that past disagreements and contretemps can stop getting in the way of the path forward. Our hope is that this report will serve as a significant contribution to that process. Has it or will it?
Well, I think yes, it has, and yes, it will. Obviously, the fact that it was overwhelmingly voted in by the council, that is the will of the people. They are elected officials. They're carrying the water on behalf of constituency bases. If our base needed to know exactly the ramifications of what we're doing well and what we need to improve in, that was worthy. And as I said, before we even had this $400,000 study commission, we were in the midst of creating and had gone through the final stages of an RFP for basically a strategic plan. What we will do now, using this as sort of a cornerstone piece, is that we can still move forward with strategic planning, and now we have this as a perspective.
Were there particular insights or recommendations that you found particularly helpful or
Well, I have, of course, we found that there was a lot of common ground and agreement. I think that for the most part, what the issues were a lot of the response was, MPD is doing a good job. However, we'd like to see them do more or better, you know. And I agree, we're about systems improvement is one of our core values. I think one of the areas that they've touched upon that I've always felt a little behind the curve is soliciting authentic community input. You know, we have tried through survey mechanisms, through community forums and the like, but oftentimes I'm playing to a crowd that is a known commodity. They have fine representation. We know where they stand on the issues. But being able to truly gauge how we're doing in more underrepresented communities has always been a challenge for us in terms of truly discerning what the pulse is in terms of trust factors and how we could be better.
Is that a way of saying that people who are angry make their positions known more aggressively than people who aren't angry?
No, I actually say to the converse. The people who like the police tend to weigh in more heavily on our survey instruments, whether we're sending them out through email, whether we're looking through constituents or non-for-profit groups that are sort of conventional. We tend to get a lot more acceptance from people than we do hearing the acrimonious comments or the comments where we need to have constructive feedback. But it's not because we aren't worthy of constructive feedback. It's just harder to tap into that systemically to really accurately know where we could be doing more.
So the community response team and Amelia Royko-Moyer and people who are pretty critical of the department.
Very critical.
Do you think they are a small minority of the general larger community?
I think it would depend on the issue, because there are some issues where we actually find agreement. Amelia Royko and the community response team, Chris Taylor and others, thought there was a definitive need in the arena or the area of officer-involved critical incidents where someone is killed, that that ought to be done by an independent investigative body. And in the midst of what has only been very high levels of partisan bickering for the last 10 years or so, they managed to create legislation that was signed into law that realized that. And we think from a public policy standpoint, that was a good thing. So it's not that we're contrarians on everything that that group has had to say, but it's sometimes I think they're more nuanced and more extreme than perhaps what I think of what I hear from other people in other parts of the community in terms of what their triage of lists are.
But in terms of officer-involved shootings,
yeah.
There was a recommendation in the OIR group report for administrative investigations of all shootings and preliminary conversations or interviews of officers before the shift is done, which you and the department are not endorsing.
Well, to some extent, we at least get what we call a public safety snapshot exception to just know the basics of what happened is a very thumbnail sketch. But as you might imagine, trained in law issues is that a police officer does not forfeit Fifth and Sixth Amendment constitutional rights any more than a lay person. So, frankly, I think that owing to the way that we are currently doing the process, we're more likely to get officer participation and full statements if we continue down the path we are currently operating under as a best practice, as opposed to insisting upon it, have someone say, I'm not going to talk or talk to my lawyer, and then we only have the witness statements or the construction of the incident forensically and otherwise.
The two biggest recommendations from the OIR report were probably to consider changing the policy on use of force and to enhance civilian oversight by establishing an independent auditor reporting to a civilian review board. What on the independent auditor, the way I read your response is, well, okay, if the policymakers think it's a great idea, we'll go along with it. It's going to be expensive. We don't know. How do you think such an office and committee or oversight panel would work? And who should hold the laboring oar in devising and defining that auditor and committee? Is it going to be you in the department or leave it to the council and the advocates who want to make it happen?
Well, I think some of it is going to be predetermined by state law and what's currently on the books. One of the questions I always get asked is that some of the asks that they want out of a civilian oversight committee look eerily reminiscent and similar to the statutory mechanism that has already been crafted with respect to hiring, firing, disciplining, and that's called the Police and Fire Commission. And it's been on the books in Wisconsin for over 100 years. So to some extent, people a lot smarter in the law than me, or people who want to sort of create a law change, a sea change at the state level, are going to have to understand that that lane is already being occupied by a statutorily authorized body called the Police and Fire Commission. They are citizens. They have staggered terms. They are certainly by no means a rubber stamp agency on everything I have brought to them. So you already have the PFC in place. I guess my question would have been is, they can't be housed by the Madison Police Department. They certainly can't be paid by me, because in that sense, you've avoided, there's already going to be a specter of collusion if they report to me. That's why I say it's a funding issue and a policy issue above and beyond what the PFC currently does, and where would they be housed and who would they be responsible to. I just wonder if to some extent there isn't some redundancy of function here, because as you know, we have the Fourth Estate that certainly keeps our feet to the fire when we screw up. We have criminal culpability in the form of the Department of Justice and civil rights investigations, as well as state investigations. We have civil liability, which we know all too well will hold or alter practices in the field. So there are a number of, and then we have the PFC. So to suggest that at this point we're going from, that we have no civilian oversight into the affairs of the police, is a little bit disingenuous, because there are, in fact, parameters in place that provide some of those functions. Now, if they want to have, like the Public Service Review Committee, the PSRC, that reports to the council, those have some alders, and those also have some citizens. If they want to adopt certain projects or policies or procedures, that's theoretically part of their mission statement now. It's just that that committee has sort of been an asterisk in time. I don't know how much gravitas they've been given, or how much acknowledgement their works provide the council, or how instructive it is to the mayor. Maybe you could re-engineer that. Or if you want, obviously, the cited industry standard that was in our report was the Denver Sheriff's Office. But, and again, it's a huge office. It has an annual budget of $1.25 million or thereabouts. I'm not saying that the operation couldn't be curtailed. Let's say it's $200,000, $250,000. That's an annual occurring expense. And my question, more rhetorically than other, is what happens when, let's say, giving us the benefit of the doubt, the first couple of decisions that are referred to this ombudsman or this third-party independent oversight, what if they actually say, yes, the police act squarely? Are we going to hear the hackles from our constituents say, another rubber stamping administrative bureaucracy? What's it done for us? So we've created something. Does it have any more persuasive abilities to depart from what we currently have in place as checks and balances on police practice?
And that was just a rhetorical question.
Totally, totally.
You cited the OIR group's reference to Denver. I got the sense from your response that you published in a few months ago that you think the OIR, this is one of the OIR group's default positions, that they're big fans of creating new bodies of civilian oversight for police, and this is something that they
I think find. Philosophically they see that that's an attractive public policy, and I can't disagree with it if you have nothing in place. A lot of the markets they have been in or have done consulting for, quite honestly, don't have a police and fire commission in place. So they do look for stopgap measures or ombudsmans or some sort of oversight.
So I take it from your answer that you're not going to take any initiative to design an auditor and a review body, that if the council or the mayor or the Public Safety Review Board want to initiate it, you will participate and cooperate,
yeah,
but it's up to them to take the laboring oar.
Yeah, because the more it looks
like...
And to fund it, exactly. Because the more it looks like we're encroaching on that mission, the more it looks like manipulation, co-option, I'm hijacking it in. And if it's going to be independent, it has to be truly an arm's-length independent relationship.
Okay. Let's talk about use of force. In 2017, Madison police officers used force 229 times out of 144,586 calls for service. But as we all know, it only takes one personal tragedy or one community outrage to
clearly
be a disaster on all parts. The OIR group said you should explore Scotland's de-escalation method and the United Kingdom's national decision-making model for police and adapt these concepts to Madison police challenges, that you should consider using a more restrictive standard than the so-called objective reasonableness that's in the Supreme Court decision of Graham versus Connor. Neither you nor the city attorney seemed too impressed by those recommendations.
Well, impressed isn't really the word. It's just right now that is the legal predicate or precedent, as you will. It's Graham versus Connor. Objective reasonableness has been on the books since 1989. It is the standard for which the Wisconsin Department of Justice trains and certifies all law enforcement officers working in the state. So for us to adopt a different mantra or something distinctively different arguably means that we're at odds with the certifying body that serves as that certifying body for all of law enforcement. And I also wonder to some extent if we're not getting a little bit into some semantics games, because at the end of the day, if police aren't exploring and exhausting all other means that preclude lethal force, ultimately we're going to be held liable for those.
But as to what the published standard would be, City Attorney Michael May said as part of his response that he knows of no other police department in the United States that uses a more stringent standard than Graham versus Connor. But as I read the San Francisco Police Department use of force evaluation, as it says in its own general orders, they have a general order that builds upon the principles but adds additional factors and is more restrictive than the constitutional standard and state law. So there are departments that are going beyond Graham versus Connor, and in fact there's a legislation pending in California that would make it statewide. Mm-hmm. So is this, even though Graham versus Connor is good law, and as you say, it's not even as old as the Miranda decision, so you can't dismiss it as though it's 30 years old, but it's not correct to say that nobody else is considering going beyond it and being more restrictive. So is it possible that a more restrictive standard would be a good idea?
Well, I think even when I've read some of the policies you've invoked, I sort of look at what are they saying at its bottom line. And the bottom line is human life is sacred. We're entrusted with preserving and protecting human life. And deadly force, lethal force, should only be used as a last resort. And I think even looking at the San Francisco standard, I don't know that it's tomato, tomato, potato, potato. I think at the end of the day, have you, as a preclusionary matter, identified all alternative options short of going with lethal force? And I think that is what the impetus of the training has to be, what the culture has to be. And there has to be a continuing commitment to how do we wait for backup? How do we create space and time? Do we look for cover? And in some instances, as I've seen over the course of my time as chief, do we just disengage and walk away altogether?
Does anybody have the authority to impose a different standard other than you?
Impose a different standard. I suspect we could, as long as we're not undercutting constitutional standards, the chief of police has the prerogative of saying that we're going to be more restrictive or ergo provide greater rights to our citizens. I suspect that some would argue that that is within the purview of elected officials, and I would obviously vehemently disagree with that. I think that goes to the essence of police operations, subject matter experts. And so unless or until otherwise ordered in some other means, we adhere to the Supreme Court precedents.
We're talking with Mike Koval. We're the chief of the Madison Police Department. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. It's the May 2018 episode of Access City Hall on the Madison City Channel. We hope you'll stay with us.
Did you know that people born from 1945 through 1965 have the highest rates of hepatitis C? But most don't know they're infected? People can live for decades without symptoms. But over time, hepatitis C can cause serious health problems. If you were born during these years, the CDC now recommends that you get a blood test for hepatitis C. So talk to your doctor and find out if you have hepatitis C. It could save your life. no more.
Queen is just my everything.
His smile did it. His smile, his eyes, his knowledge. My landlord, he decided that he wanted me to move based on the fact that I was transgender. Let's just respect people in everyday life for just being human.
Welcome back to the May 2018 episode of Access City Hall on the Masson City Channel. I'm Stu Levitan. We're talking with Masson Police Chief Mike Koval. Let's get back to you and David Cooper and start with Janelle Laird. Yeah. And the episode at Easttown Mall in June of 2016. Ms. Laird, 18-year-old African-American woman, believes that someone at the mall has stolen her cell phone. She confronts somebody with a knife. She confronts somebody else with a knife. Police are called. The situation escalates, and a video is made on a cell phone of two officers striking Ms. Laird, taking her down, kneeing her in the abdomen, using a taser, handcuffing her behind her back. There is immediate community outrage. David Cooper goes after you very aggressively. The mayor raises questions. The matter is investigated by internally, it's by MPD, it's investigated, and by the Dane County Sheriff and by the DA.
Right.
And in September, about 2 months later, a report is issued going minute by minute as to what happened, explaining why every escalation of force was felt to be justified and within department guidelines. But you know that however detailed and persuasive that 10-page report was,
right,
it will never match the power of a 7-minute video that goes viral.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that?
But first, you have to acknowledge the elephant in the room, and that is any use of force, despite what we may see depicted in choreographed television scenarios or shows or movies or whatever. Any use of force is it's going to be the lawful but awful component. You can work within the parameters of what is trained and what is permissible, but that begs the question that the optics can suck. So I can look at this as a trained defense and arrest tactics instructor and say the conformity of what was trained and what the subject was resisting and how the officers responded falls within the window of options that they could use. But that defies the logic that as a father of two kids myself, I can understand, acknowledge, and embrace the community sentiment that says, but God, that looked horrible. I get it. The optics aren't great, and we have to use each one of these use of force issues as an opportunity to see, did we exhaust all other means? What other things could have been done to divert that? And frankly, continue to question, from a systems improvement standpoint, the fact that you can do things, that's a given. What other things could be done that create that sort of less spectacle, as you will, as some people describe it. So we acknowledge that that has to be something that has to be embraced. And we also have to have that understanding that for a lot of people, if I go to lay hands on you, it's offensive. But we have to understand that a lot of the people that we are dealing with are on that particular day are at their maddest, baddest, or saddest. And a 120-pound person can provide all the work that four or five cops can handle. And sometimes you just have to be very quick about it. You have to decentralize them, put them down on the ground, get them in handcuffs. The sooner the struggle or the conflict is over, the better. But that never really looks great, quite frankly. The key is, how do we minimize even having to go to use of force? How do we continue to use de-escalation techniques, professional communication, mediation? And how can we, if two guys are disturbing at a bar, maybe if I send four or five cops, our mere presence will create acquiescence and go with the flow. So we have to constantly be thinking about every call we go on, not just use of force calls, every call we go on should be probative in terms of how could that have gone better? What other options would we have had?
Well, as you review the Janelle Laird situation, have you identified places where, yes, you operated within the SOP, but here's something else you could have done that might have reduced the need for use of force and had produced a situation with better optics?
Well, we just basically, with any use of force, things like that, we go through our use of force coordinator, we go through reports, we look at the investigative models that were returned from the county and from our own internal dynamics. We talk to the officers, we sort of understand what were they thinking, what were they doing, look at their reports. And so all of that is talked about, discussed, tabletop. Lots of stuff like that are very constructive as a postscript. That's not to suggest that at the end of the day, and I know some people don't like to hear that term, but theoretically those officers, as you know, had some soft tissue issue as well, and they were victims. And owing to their willingness to participate in a community restorative court, we can say that Ms. Laird, to this date, doesn't have a record of that prosecution. She never will have had a CCAP entry because we worked very diligently behind the scenes to avoid that from happening.
So when David Cooper criticizes you and the department, criticizes the officers and, and their exercise, in the immediacy of the event, and then renews the criticism even after reading the report, How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, a mentor is a mentor is a mentor is a mentor. I will never, I have only the utmost respect for him, profound love. He's on my Mount Rushmore of law enforcement luminaries who have shaped me in the chief I am today, along with Robert Trojanowicz from Michigan State, the Flint, Michigan Community Policing Experiment. Professor Herman Goldstein from our own University of Wisconsin, Community Policing and Problem-Oriented Policing. Mike Scott, his progeny. And David Cooper. They're all on my Mount Rushmore. And so that doesn't lessen or diminish what they have done to form me into which I still respect them for. But in some instances, as we have had a chance to hash out, my concern has been the essence of his timed and public remarks. I believe that he knows full well that unless or until such time as we know all of the facts and we have all of those facts come to light, it's premature to use your public personage in terms of decrying what might not be all of the facts that are available to you at that time. And so from a timing standpoint, that's where we have at times taken issue with one another. That doesn't mean I don't respect his opinions and that he has certainly earned the right to voice those opinions after his complete lifetime of service to our profession. And he has advanced the progressivism of policing, for which I'm deeply beholden to him. But in some instances, it comes down to a question of timing and picking your spots about when and where to comment publicly.
Given what you just said about Mount Rushmore and mentoring someone, it really, you must have been very upset at him.
I was.
In December 2015 to write an email, when you provide your Monday morning sermons from your cloistered farmette in Blue Mounds, second-guessing our officers in life and death decisions, you are being disingenuous and quickly losing credibility. I can no longer abide by your antics. What would move you to write such an email? I mean, if this is the email you send, how many do you write and then delete?
Well, it depends.
Not enough.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of people that say, before you hit the send button, Chief, do you mind if I just look over your shoulder? And again, I think that was a different time, and I think that was over a different incident. I don't think that
it was
that
a few months before the Janelle Laird. But
yeah,
but
it was coming off the hands of another officer-involved critical incident, quite frankly. And I think, again, as I said at the outset, I tend not to be dispassionate. I tend to let those who know me know exactly how I feel. And I believe in his heart of hearts, he loves the MPD. He loves the legacy he's created. And I know he advances the efforts of what we're trying to accomplish. And it was with that sort of a lens on my keyboard at the time that I was incredulous that he could be, at that point, so publicly critical, because at that time, based on that incident, he would not have known all of the facts attendant to what he was commenting on.
Talk about a series of non-use of force instances, but which have contributed to some of community difficulties. There have
Sure.
been a series of incidents over the past couple of years where officers wrote some really offensive things. You had that brainstorming whiteboard mm-hmm. session for dealing with problems at the top of State Street, and officers suggested things like unlimited heroin laced with fentanyl, carpet bombing, tiger pits, quicksand, organic lava flow. You had two officers writing on online petitions that progressives are ass bags, and speaking to department critics, go F yourselves, and talking about glory-holing nincompoops who are out of touch with reality, and so on.
All of the officers that you've mentioned in the two incidents there were all brought before professional standards, and all of them went through a predetermination process to look at the culpability and what standards, code of conduct that they had violated, and all met with varying degrees of resolution.
Does that mean there was varying degrees of resolution?
Because it would apply based on your past history.
Okay.
If this is your first foray where you've used bad judgment and have done something inappropriate, that would be different than someone who has had some chronic issues of discipline.
Okay, so some or all of them may have been disciplined.
Yes, especially the ones that went to the online sort of inappropriate commentaries.
Would it have been more serious that one of them insulted progressives? Progressives are ass bags. Mm-hmm. Would it have been a more serious offense if instead of making a political insult, the insult was based on race?
I think any time that you use race, that is the most specious of things, because that's the most divisive. I mean, politics is what politics is in Madison, and it forever will be. There's incredible polarization and marginalization relative to political speech in this community, as you know. But race is the most specious and should be dealt with the most punitively.
I was watching a video on your YouTube channel talking about, in which you said that the great thing is that you have an academy and we can shape the clay at the potter's wheel at the academy. These are officers that you either hired, recruited, or trained, mm-hmm. along with several of the officers who've engaged in use of force mm-hmm. In controversial and tragic manner. What went wrong?
Well, again, the culture that we're trying to cultivate or create or foster, if you will, I think is still on solid ground, in the sense that the people we recruit or the people who ultimately decide to take the oath of office, I think are incredibly progressive. I think they're incredibly selfless. They have a guardian mindset. They truly are do-gooders. They come to us from every academic major under the sun. And I think that in the course of the identification and stratification through backgrounding, and then the training, the type of training, and the emphasis we place on training, we're trying as best we can to create a best practice climate culture, if you will. That's not to say that there won't be those anomalous acts, those speed bumps, those hiccups, those outliers where people act profoundly poorly. And for when their behavior is violative of who we are in our code of conduct or our standard operating procedures, then they have to be held accountable as well.
Do you have an established protocol for trying to identify and treat officers with any degree of emotional or substance abuse issues?
What we're doing is that we're working on a software program now, sort of an early intervention system, an EIS system, which will start to chronicle benchmarks like looking at how sick leave is done, or looking at those various incidents which may have started as benign incivility complaints to the public, and in that way start to put together sort of a metrics, if you will, of those who might be trajecting a way that is undesirable.
Speaking of discipline, I have to ask about the PFC found that you had violated Department Code of Conduct and Administrative Procedures when you referred to Tony Robinson's grandmother, Sharon Irwin, is a raging lunatic. Mm-hmm. And the commission found that although you violated the standards, it did not rise to the level of justifying suspension, demotion, or discharge, which they found to be the only avenues of discipline available to it under state statute. Mm-hmm. What would you have done if a subordinate had engaged in that conduct?
Still would have investigated what was done and said, well, what do you have to say for yourself? And when I had the opportunity to speak up in a public hearing, a police and fire commission, I owned it, I acknowledged it, I stated my regret for having uttered it, and I apologized. Beyond that, I don't think I would have done anything differently with an officer who had absolutely, in my case, 35 years without a civilian complaint ever sustained.
We just got a couple minutes left. You wrote a blog post last October in which you proclaimed that you had canceled your NFL cable subscription in protest to Colin Kaepernick and others kneeling during...
Well, I never mentioned him by name.
No, but you referred to taking a knee.
All I said is that on the day that that Wednesday came out, I said we were going to be rededicating the law enforcement memorial up on Pinckney. And this was a moment to honor what had otherwise been desecrated. And in light of all the contemporary things that were going on about defiling what I think are the service of military and police, among others, rather than take a knee for something, why don't you stand for something and show up for the law enforcement memorial? And to that extent, I can also say, yes, I can vote with my feet, as can any other citizen or constituent. And one of the things that I've tried to say is that at the outset of that same preamble that you noted in the blog, I said, I'm all about the First Amendment, and the First Amendment says freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. Not to get too technical on people, but that's a business model. There is no government intrusion into anybody's rights.
But as a practical matter, you know that in this community, a good proportion of the general citizenry and probably a greater proportion of people of the minority community think that what Colin Kaepernick did was righteous,
and that's fine.
But from the perspective of community relations, was it a good idea for? I mean, you could have said everything about stand up for the police and honor the and come to the celebration, but tactically and practically, was it a good idea to have that preamble about taking a knee being a bad thing? I mean, from the department's perspective.
And again, I want to be respectful and stay in my lane, but I also think that I, as someone who represents 470 cops who selflessly are willing to literally sacrifice their very lives on a daily basis for constituents, I have a right to say I would like to stand in defense of police. Because what we are being judged by, and frankly, I don't know what we're being judged by, because that whole demonstration to me had evidence of mission creep. It was military, it was police, and then it wasn't military. So it's all over the map. I'm just saying for me, myself, and I'm standing in defense of police.
You mentioned a moment ago 35 years in the field. How much longer?
Oh, the bell's going off, so maybe I don't have to answer that question. To be determined, as long as I still can continue to move the needle and doing progressive things on community engagement, we're doing a lot of challenging, great things right now, I want to continue to persist at it.
If you believed, if you came to believe that for the reset that the OIG report referred to, or the IR report referred to, if you believed that your retirement was necessary for that reset, would you retire?
I think it would be definitely weigh heavily on my mind if that's all it took to endear the entire Madison community to more embracing of the MPD. If I was the reason there wasn't acceptance of the MPD, then I would consider that as an option.
But as we sit here today, you expect that we'll be back doing this again in another year?
Well, let's hope so. I'm sort of the Al-Anon theory when it comes to being a police chief, one day at a time.
Well, that's all the time that we have on this one day. We appreciate your being with us. On behalf of everyone at the Madison City Channel and specifically the crew at Access City Hall, I'm Stu Levitan. Thanks very much for watching.
Thank you. Appreciate it.